Hi, I'm Ken Sweeney. This is The Comfortable Spot. Welcome. Today, I'm joined by historian Nadia Dobryanska. Originally from Ukraine, Nadia arrived in Ireland following the invasion of Ukraine by Russian forces in February 2022. Nadia and her immediate family are now settled in East Cork, but this is not the first time Nadia has travelled to the island of Ireland, as she completed her history studies at Queen's University in Belfast in 2018. Nadia has a keen interest in Irish culture and language, so I invited her onto the podcast to discuss her experiences living in Ireland now. I also wanted to chat with Nadia about the future of her native country and what, in her opinion, was the motivation behind the Russian invasion. So I hope you're sitting comfortably and happy to stay with us. Nadia, hi, how are you? Thanks for joining me on The Comfortable Spot.
Thanks for having me.
It's Friday here where we are, so it's a good day, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it because I'm going to Galway to see a friend today. So, looking forward to the end of the day.
Galway is always a lovely place to go to weekends. So, look, I've been following you on Twitter and I came across your profile there. And I was also listening to a couple of podcasts and a couple of articles that you were involved with. So, this is kind of a great example of multiculturalism and diversity in one area and so on. But just to get off on our foot here, you are originally from Ukraine, but you studied history in Ireland and you also are a native speaker of our language. Is that right?
Sort of. So I am indeed Ukrainian and I'm native speaker of Ukrainian. And I am studying Irish. Probably I wouldn't say that I'm very fluent, but some people say that I am. And I'm never quite sure this is because they think that their Irish is not great or am I as good as I am? I don't know. I usually think that I feel that there's so much to learn. And I've been studying Irish only for 4 years now. I have a master's from Queen's University Belfast in Irish studies. And I did mostly history and politics of Ireland. So, yeah.
Well, I think that you've actually taken the time to learn Irish is just incredible because I'm a perfect example. I've had 40 years of Irish language training and it hasn't even seeped in one little bit. I still have trouble watching TG Carter in the rugby and I still get frustrated that there's no English subtitles in it. So I'm going to say you're fluent. Okay, just leave it at that. I know I'm the worst person in the world because I've two kids and they're fluent in English and Polish. My wife is Polish as well. I'm the only one who can only speak one language and it's now beginning to work against me because one is 9 and one is 6 and they're having their secret conversations in Polish. So I'm kind of really struggling. I'm sitting there watching the telly and they're laughing. I'm going, what are you saying? You know? So it's beginning to work against me. So I'm going to have to do something about it. I don't know whether I'll have to get a crash course in Polish or something like that just to keep up. But I wanted to go right back. Of course, everyone talks about Ukraine. It's in the news at the moment for obvious reasons. But I wanted to ask you about growing up in Ukraine. Life as a teenager for you in Ukraine, where are you originally from and what was it like? Was it an exciting time? Because, I mean, history says it was an exciting time. So I'm just curious to know what it was like for you.
It's different for different people. So I was lucky that I was born in Kyiv and my parents had accommodation there from the state because they were working for the National Academy of Science. And we were able to get accommodation because there was, as you know, there was no private property. So it's not that they could buy it. So through their work, they got accommodation at the very edge of Kyiv when I was born. And then when I went to school, when I was 7, almost 8, we moved into town, into Pechersk district. And it was a very good place to grow up because my parents picked a spot. So there were a few schools around and I went to one of them where I was doing French in my as a foreign language for the first 3 years. And then they took me to another school where I had English and German. And these were quite good schools. And I guess as a teenager, I was just as grumpy as you can get at that age. And because my family could afford it, they were sending me to lots of workshops and I was doing extracurricular English and I think at that time, when I was a teenager, I was What was I doing? I used to do like ballroom dancing because it was so popular in at the time in Ukraine. And then I was doing martial arts, and I think when I was a teenager, I quit all of that. I was just focusing in my studies, and I was a real nerd, reading fantasy books, listening to heavy metal, and not really so I'm socializing online with people from all over the world back in the day. While my classmates were drinking their lives out of them at the same time. So probably I'm not really representative, but I'm representative of the nerdy bit of Ukrainians in Kyiv.
Well, I mean, that's perfectly normal. It's almost trendy to be nerdy nowadays. I wanted to ask you about social media. Actually, you touched on it there. What was social media like when you were a teenager in Ukraine? Was it easily accessible?
So at that time it was we had dial-up, so I would keep my parents' phone line busy when I would try to talk to people. So there were chat rooms back in the day, and there were also what you call we called them forums in
Yep,
Ukrainian. I
that's
think like
right.
a post like board discussion boards, is that what you call them? And yeah, so I would hang out on discussion boards about Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, and would make some friends and even meet some of them. In my last year of school, I went on the first real life meeting with people from the Harry Potter board in Kyiv. It was so fascinating. Oh, God.
At that time, Ukraine was still fairly new as an independent state. Was there an air of excitement in the country? I mean, although you were a teenager, so maybe a lot of that passed over you, but looking back on it, was the country, say, ambitious already at that point?
Well, yeah, I was a kid at the time, but my parents used to be involved in politics of the 80s and the 90s in Ukraine. So I was brought up really like by Irish standards, nationalists, by Ukrainian standards, probably patriotic. It doesn't amount to nationalism. Well, by the our measurement of right, left, and that on. But having studied Irish politics, probably it's just baseline nationalist. Like I want an independent Ukraine. And I remember growing up when at the turn of early 90s, my father would take part, would organize peaceful protests for Ukrainian independence and for, well, you probably wouldn't call this home rule, but like for more self-governance in the Soviet Union so that Ukraine can be governed from Ukraine. And when the and my mother was really terrified that my dad would be sent to the Siberia because of that, and I kind of had the sense when I was very young that this is dangerous. And but since when independence came in, I mean, I was very young, so I could only remember that I have a picture of me on the national chain. If you've There was this long, long chain across the country on the National Unity Day on 22nd of January in 1990. I was like 2.5 years old, but I have a picture of me and with the balloon and my mom standing there, calling for unity and independence of Ukraine. And I remember, I mean, because this independence was bloodless, so very many processes stayed the way that they used to be in the Soviet Union. When I was like in my late 20s, I was working as a very young deputy chief of law of a young party in the parliament, and when I came in to work there, I realized that I could picture this parliament being in the 80s. It's like the red carpets and the curtains and the systems are still from the Soviet Union, even though the people are new and the laws are democratic and there is market economy, but still like the spirit is still in there. And I was thinking, like, God, how different it is from what I was studying as a law student, that there's this new brave new world, but a lot of systems are still rigid. But then looking at what I've discovered in Ireland, it's like some of the things that we've been hating about the Soviet Union and like the new Ukrainian state had very much to do with just like hereditary problems of old order when you're moving to the new order. So it's like the similar when the Irish Free State came into being. They didn't dismantle every single thing that stayed from the UK, from the British Empire. So I reconciled with this to looking at the comparative perspective for myself. And but I remember when in 2014, 2005, I was in my last year of school and there was the Orange Revolution. That's when there was this big I was there with my parents, and I was 16 or 17 already. So it was a big deal, and it was a big major point when in my life suddenly you see that there is this big divide among people, and that I didn't lose friends, but me and my best friend at school, we suddenly appeared on different sides of barricades because obviously I was like nationalist and pro EU, pro European choice of Ukraine. And she was the daughter of the secretary of the Communist Party of
Oh,
Ukraine.
okay. That must
So,
have been
yeah.
that must have been so awkward for you though, because as a young person, it must be difficult to have to deal with those type of emotions that, in a sense, they're not really necessary. It's not like you've fallen out over a boy, you know, or it's not like you've stole he she stole something for you or from you or something like that. You're being forced into this situation because A, of parents, two, of heritage, and three, of political situations. So that must have been very stressful, was it?
You see, because the way that I was brought up, and I didn't feel that it was something alien to me. So I really believe that Ukraine has to be independent, and I wanted to be independent. And so when a friend says basically that we want us to be devoured by Russia in the long run because our president is going to be pro-Russian and hating everything Ukrainian, to me, it was a very clear thing that I made personal effort not to fall out with her. And she wasn't really fighting with me because maybe what you're describing is was her case, if you know what I mean. Maybe she didn't have a strong belief herself, because she this was the matter of her upbringing.
Peer
And
pressure,
before,
yeah.
until then, I didn't really, she was not a, like ethnic Russian, of course, which were like I had another friend who was brought up like Russian Jewish, and she was felt that Ukrainian, everything Ukrainian is alien to her. She was quite hostile to being a minority in like in independent Ukraine, and probably this was how her parents felt. But anyway, so this with this friend, we didn't have this hostility, but I kind of felt that I'm making an effort with her. Yeah, so I just wanted to say that my grandfather was the staunch nationalist from Donetsk, a Ukrainian-speaking nationalist. So whenever there is this talk about, oh God, there's what about Russian speakers and ethnic Russians in Donetsk, I'm like, well, there are other people there too, and he was really disappointed within the kind of independence that we had. And I remember him, like my dad, quoting him saying that this is not the independence I want. I want better. And at that time, I didn't, as a child, when I heard this in the 90s, I didn't understand what this was. Like, what do you want? Like, there is an independence. But like maybe, like thinking about the disappointment of some Irish people after the Civil War with the project, the Irish Free State they ended up in. When I look at that, I think, okay, yeah, that's how it can work. And now I look, having when I grew up and went to work in the parliament and worked with the consulted the governmental, like the consulted ministries and some policy issues, I realized that, yeah, we have very much of not that new independent Ukraine that probably my granddad would have wanted.
Ukraine came to the fore of international media, and obviously our vision of Ukraine came with the Orange Revolution. Before that, we just knew that, especially in Ireland, you were a pretty good football team, and that you had a habit of winning the Eurovision with really dramatic songs. So we knew about Ukraine, and you know, of course, the mistake that everybody makes is the Ukraine. You know, and we always called it, oh yeah, the Ukraine, yeah. My wife is Polish, as I said. She was in Ireland around 2005, so we kind of witnessed this. And it was great to have her there because she was able to give me a completely different perspective to what was on, say, Irish news channels and so on, and the British news channels. I think it was at that stage that people began to realize that Ukraine was definitely in the shadow of Russia, and this is kind of something that was going to happen. Did it frustrate you as a teenager having a kind of this cloud of hanging over you, or did you never think about that? Was it just something that you just went on and got on with? Because I suppose, in a sense, you have to, don't you? You have to try and get on with it.
Well, it's difficult to say because on one hand, as a teenager, like much of my communication online was with centered, for example, with like Russian-speaking fans. Like we can, Ukrainian internet was very small, and I was talking to people on Russian discussion boards too, and had some friends there online. And I didn't. My English was getting better, but still, it wasn't good enough to communicate with the Anglosphere at that time. And I had Russian because I was just growing up in in Ukraine, listening to Russian on the telly and reading Russian books, and some people in my environment spoke Russian, so I picked it up. And so I did feel this. Well, it's hard to think what it was like when I was a teenager, because definitely as a kid I was immersed more in my teenage plight, fighting with parents and wanting to break free and all that, if you know what I mean. But definitely when I went to the university, like in my late teens, I definitely felt that this was the this Russian influence on Ukraine was way too strong. I went into the university right after the Orange Revolution, and my university, National University of Kyiv Mohyla Academy, was a very new project, restored medieval, like early modern university that was restored in the 90s. And so there was this strong drive for an independent and thriving Ukraine, which definitely was in conflict with pro-Russian forces in Ukraine and with obviously Russian forces later on. And so I had definitely had this sense that we, like, I don't know if you're aware of that, but in this former Soviet Union areas, there was this tendency, at least while I was following this, for legislatures to follow the legislation of Russia to resolve certain issues. And Ukraine, and after Yanukovych, Russia oriented president, came into power in Ukraine in 2010, he really was trying to follow Putin's footsteps to build and more of autocratic regime, to impose, like, if there was a Russian legislation about something restricting access to abortions, you would almost predict that this would happen in Ukraine too. Like, there would be effort to do that, and in other spheres too. So it was, when I was watching this, it was really, really annoying. But the question about Russia is more than just a question about what is the national idea, or what's the ethnicity behind what should Ukrainians merge with Russians, like this? Ukrainians definitely don't want that. But it was also about the choice of democracy versus autocracy. So Yanukovych wouldn't necessarily want us to become Russians, but he would definitely want us to accept political abuse, lack of transparency of the government,
Control of state
abuse.
media.
Suppressing free media and no justice whatsoever in courts, like police violence. And so this was not just some sort of like abstract authoritarianism on the side of Yanukovych. We definitely could see that where it's headed. We could see Russia living that way. We definitely didn't want that. I didn't want that. And when in 2013, at the end of 2014, 13, the Euromaidan revolution started, I wasn't there. I wasn't at the early protests about because Yanukovych refused to sign the EU association agreement. At that time, I was very, like, unlike some of my friends, I was very cynical and disappointed and bitter, and thinking he probably would have been was bluffing all the time. He wouldn't sign it. Like, this is not like him. But other people were outraged and they were protesting. And after he started this horrible crackdown, and my best friend was at night at that place where the crackdown was, but luckily she left like half an hour or an hour before that. So in the morning when I woke up, I was after a visit to Tajikistan to a conference and to visiting some ministries for as an exchange event. I woke up in the morning reading the news and ringing her, like, "Are you alive? Like, what happened? Like, are you okay?" And she was fine. But this was the moment, the breaking turn, when I just felt that, yeah, I'm protesting against that, and I will be standing there till the very end. And of course, I couldn't predict that it would turn into like horrible crackdown, that almost 100 people would be killed by bloody snipers. Like, it's like a bloody Sunday multiplied a few times. It's just horrendous.
And the funny thing is that, in the light of what's happening now, that's kind of been forgotten a little bit, which is kind of strange, isn't it? Because people think that this is what's happened now with Ukraine and Russia, has just happened overnight, or it's just like, ba-dam, we're here. You know, whereas if they look back in terms of even just 10 years over, like, you can see that it was brewing all the time. And Crimea was kind of like an end game. Like, it wasn't the beginning, as a lot of people thought. I think we can probably go back to that in a while, because we could probably go and talk about that for another half an hour. But I did want to catch up on you and find out, you know, about that later on. But before we do, I wanted to get back to the fact that you're here. And, you know, you're not just here because of what's happened in Ukraine now. You were here before. You were on our island before. And I'm just wondering, I'm sure, was it that when you decided to come to Ireland, was it that you felt that it was maybe it was practical? Or was it something that you had a kind of a desire for? Was it kind of like, oh, lovely Ireland, I really want to go there? Or maybe it was a combination. So you studied history here. And was it a choice? Was history a choice? And was Ireland a choice?
So it was Ireland was a choice, and in 2018 I had a very severe burnout working in Ukrainian human rights and policy, and I was consulting NGOs and sometimes working with ministries as well, and I really had a very bad breakdown and burnout. I had to quit my job, and at that time I was thinking, I just want to do something right for me, not the good thing to do for the country and how I see it. So I decided, okay, I had this since I was a teenager. I've been listening to Irish trad music and trying to learn some Irish. It didn't work out at that time because I had a very strange Russian textbook which didn't quite write. I thought it was just wrong at this time.
I have to jump in. You had a Russian textbook on Irish language?
Yeah, because they teach Irish in Moscow University.
Oh, right. Okay, because
it's I don't know if they got this was a university book, but basically they were just getting. I can't explain this, but basically they were trying to explain Irish without explaining the basic rule lahan lahan quel quel. So they were trying to explain spelling without explaining this rule, and it made no sense. And I thought, probably I'm an idiot. You know, if people speak Irish, and you know, it was spoken for like 1,000 years, so probably there's something wrong with me, and I didn't think at the time that there could be something wrong with the book. So anyway,
you didn't have the key, so you couldn't get past the first point, and you were looking over that wall going, that's all the answers there, but I don't know how to jump over the wall. But it was crazy. So that book was actually it was a published book, and it was people were using it in academic circles.
Well, I think so, because it was PDF
right
somewhere it got online. It was mid-2000s, it wasn't, you know, internet was small, and at that time I wasn't sure. Like later on I ordered a textbook from Ireland in English, but at that time I had another obstacle. I didn't trust my own knowledge of English, so in terms of pronunciation, I wasn't quite, you know, learning Irish through another language. I wasn't sure, so I put it off. And so in 2018, I started using Duolingo, and it worked out really well with Irish. So at the point when I had a burnout, I was already recovering my Irish, doing good progress, and thinking, okay, I'll just go to Ireland. And I thought that doing a degree would be an interesting way to get to know the country, because my degree is in law, so it wouldn't be easy for me to get a job in Ireland. It's not a STEM profession. So I was looking for funding, and I found a scholarship from the British government for like young leaders and achieving scholarship. And actually it used to be available for the Irish students too, but up until a certain point when it was cancelled for the Irish, but Ukrainians are still on the list of eligible students. So I applied, eventually I won, thankfully, and I decided that I will go to Belfast because Northern Ireland is an Ireland. And it was a very intense experience for me. And thankfully my program was Irish Studies at Queen's University Belfast is very flexible, so I could really, really change. I was choose from between politics and anthropology and history. And I first went for politics, political science subjects, because I felt that it's close to lawyering, and it really didn't work well for me. And I ended up doing history, which is my cup of tea.
And when you say history, is there a particular part of history that you study, particular timelines?
Yeah. So I'm interested in modern Irish history, and I focused my studies on the on partition and the troubles in Belfast during partition in Ireland. And this is the subject that I'm going to write my PhD on. starting from this, well, from next month, I'm taking up a PhD in London in UCL, and I will be expanding my work on that.
I wanted to ask you about life in Belfast. Did you find that living in Belfast was completely different to, say, living in Ukraine? You know, was it a sense of like wow, or was it a sense of you had similarities to, say, life back in Ukraine and Kiev?
I mean, everything was really, really different. Even, you know, in practical things, that food is very different. And I was at first months, I was really afraid that I wouldn't feel hungry because I wouldn't get the food that I really want. If you know what I mean, there is food, but this is not exactly the food that I'm used to and I want to eat. So it was a very peculiar thing, was stressing me out. And the way that in Ukraine, in the cities, you're living in high-rise tower blocks, and in Belfast, everything is low-rise, unless these are new, very new buildings in time. But of course, like I had to, because I didn't want to live in a student bubble like many international students do, I was risk I was taking a lot of risk going out there. Because, you know, what you can read about Northern Ireland on Wikipedia is not exactly the thing that it's in real life. So I early on, very early on, I realized that you don't go around Belfast telling people that you're doing a Master in Irish Studies. You can have a misunderstanding with some people who are not exactly happy with that. And also, like, you don't go around saying, oh, I'm learning Irish. Isn't it that
Yeah.
great? It's like, no, don't do that, please.
The irony is you probably get more of a welcome as a Ukrainian, maybe in some parts.
No.
No. Okay.
No. Somehow, the fact that I was doing Irish studies and was learning Irish, playing trad, I played the flute, I was learning it. It's like it really, even like I'm not Catholic, but it puts me on the line with Catholics. And also it puts me also, so there is no, you know, don't cut me any slack. So it's like, I was learning it in practice. So I'm joking about this, but I was really, really terrified that I can get in trouble. And when I was looking for accommodation in Belfast, because my student, like I rented some private student accommodation, there were troubles there. I was looking early on for a new accommodation, and I ended up living in Loyalist area in South Belfast. And my landlady was very friendly towards Catholics. Apparently, her previous tenants were Catholics, and I kind of qualified, you know, because of what I was doing. I sort of fell in these lines, even though I was genuinely saying that, you know, I'm Ukrainian, I have nothing to do with this, but you can't just overstep that. And I'm pretty sure that these times, if you know, in Ukraine, when there's a foreigner coming in and saying that, you know, displaying the Russian version of history and telling Ukrainians that, you know, this Russia has a right to Ukraine, all this, Ukraine should be part of Russia, you know, nationality doesn't matter. People would really get cross. So I can see how these ideas, you know, the what I thought was interesting about Irish culture and history was, to some people, it was really off-putting. And I had to, where I was living in Loyalist area, I had to keep it very low key. Nobody could know that I'm going to the falls to the cultural and macadam learning Irish, that I'm playing. I couldn't play the flute at home, so during lockdowns I had to play the flute on the bogside meadows across M1 from my house, because I was living just near it, and other issues, and the family of the landlady couldn't know. So when there was a moment when the father of my landlady came in and asked, how close are Ukrainian and Russian? And I said, well, maybe they're more distant, like, than Irish and Scottish. And he was like, just looked straight through me. And I said, and I thought, maybe I should have thought of my answer better.
Yeah, but look, it's a difficult situation you're in. You know, you can't, as you say, relax in a sense. How long were you there?
Year and a half.
So you flew through your education, and what happens after that? Did you go back to Ukraine then?
Well, first I did a year of my degree, and I was volunteering with the UCL Constitution Union think tank remotely from Belfast, and they were right there. It had this project about working group on unification referendums in Ireland, and they were working on looking at constitutional and other processes, how, if there was a referendum, how they should do. And I was doing working on a qualitative poll that they held in writing up a report, and we had it published later on. And also I worked as a research assistant for the Northern Ireland historical centenary panel of historians at Queen's, and was also working on doing like research to support the website of the panel, to produce like on this day content for marking the centenary. So I had this going on, and then when my visa expired at the end of March last year, I came back to Ukraine, and I was waiting on the outcome of my PhD funding application. Because of COVID, it all went really off, what was derailed, and I had to like the funding and things. So I made a plan that I'm staying in Ukraine for this year, this academic year. I'm getting a job. I got a job in human rights, and I was applying for to do PhDs across the UK, like in Belfast, in London, in Scotland, to go ahead with my studies. And then the war started.
Okay, so you found yourself looking to get out of Ukraine, and was Ireland your first point? Was it, did you say to yourself, okay, I'm going to go back to Ireland, or was it just a case of getting to safety?
It was both. So my parents were really reluctant to leave Kyiv in the first place. So I got them out. Me and my brother, with lies, intimidation, and harassment, we got my parents out of Kyiv first hours of the invasion. And week into the invasion, I got a call from an Irish person, like a friend of friends of friends, who was coordinating like a grassroots work to get Ukrainians into Ireland. By that time, visa restrictions were lifted, and when I got this offer, at that time I was already tweeting a lot, and I was using my Twitter for like, I was looking for accommodation for some Ukrainian who wanted to send his family to Ireland, and I already knew people in Ireland, so I was kind of trying to help in between. And when this man got I got this request from him, like this offer, and suddenly my parents agreed to go. We also took my cousin's wife with her, like 3-month-old baby, and my brother's cat, and it was road to safety, but it was going to a place that I sort of know. We went to Cork, and I didn't really have the connections in the Republic, or I used to say like in the South. It's not exactly the South, but anyway. So I it was I really, really wanted to be back in Ireland anyway. But of course, it worked out that I was doing this because I was looking after my family. Probably if they didn't agree and the Russians moved further into northern Ukraine where we were, and me being a human rights worker, I would definitely, like rape and death would be easy ways out for a person of my profile. So I would definitely have fled myself and maybe to Ireland. I don't know. Probably it would. If I had this opportunity, I would probably have chosen Ireland. But because we got this offer, I just held on to it and went on.
So your journey here for the second time you came here to Cork, was that just directly from Ukraine to Ireland, or did you have a journey through maybe Poland and
We went to Poland first to cross the border because you couldn't fly out, and you can't fly into Ukraine anymore because the airports are bombarded. So we first drove my parents' car into Poland to Krakow, and it was a grueling journey, but anyway. And we stayed at my friend's house for a few nights, and we flew out of Krakow to Dublin, and so these people, the initiative, they took us down to Cork and were looking after us for the first time, until my family got the welfare benefits, and then eventually we found a house where we were living now on our own.
living in Cork now, I mean, when you got there first, I'm sure, for the want of a better word, there was a sense of duty and excitement on the part of people from Ireland, in particular Cork, to welcome people like you to come in to their communities. And I'm wondering, 6 months on now, how's that going for you? I mean, you're there. I mean, obviously you're happy, but do you get the feeling that this could be long term, or would you think that at some point or another you may be able to go back to Ukraine, even just for, a visit or whatever like that? Do you really consider Cork to be your home now, or is that still a temporary thing in your mind?
One thing is that because I want funding to do a PhD, I'm definitely staying on these islands. I'll be going back and forth between Cork and London for the next 3 years. So this would have happened regardless of the war. Thankfully, I want this funding before the invasion. So I know it's an academic merit rather than some humanitarian response. So I'm definitely here for the next 3 years, and hopefully I will be able to proceed with using my expertise further here. And but for my family, like my mother died last month, sadly
Very sorry to hear
here.
that. Yeah.
Thanks. And my cousin went back with the baby, so I'm here with my father, and he's definitely here. And we have an agreement that we're staying in this house at least for a year, so we can be, we are safe and we don't need to be worried. Where do we go from here? Because my father is retired, so there's no other way to go. So, this definitely, so we're definitely using this opportunity to stay here for as long as we have to be safe and take it from there, because it's really hard to say. I was definitely not the one thinking that it's going to be over in a few days. So I don't see this war ending this year. And I don't know what's going to happen to us next year, what it's going to be like to be for refugees across Europe. There's nowhere, even going back to Ukraine, to the areas that are not as heavily bombarded as others, everybody has to hide in shelters a number of times a day. And Russians really like long-range missiles, they can reach anywhere, literally anywhere. Like there's the when they attacked a train in Dnipropetrovsk region where they killed 25 people. I think it was a bloody train going in between times. Like it was, there's no way of knowing, no matter what you do, if you can die next moment. So I'm not subjecting my dad to that.
And the thing is, you're in a country where I think, contrary to popular belief, maybe of somebody who's not lived in Ireland, we sympathize a lot as a nation with people like you because we know what it's like. There's a vast majority of, well, I suppose we could say there's more people of Irish DNA abroad than there is of people in Ireland. So as a nation, we kind of know what it's like. We've never had an empire. We didn't have any imperial aspirations. There was nothing about Ireland that has this kind of colonialism that many, many European countries have. So I think we kind of feel like we've been in that position many times ourselves. Is it a welcoming place for you now, Ireland? Do you feel at home here, even though I know it's under very difficult circumstances?
For me, definitely it is. Like for my mother, she didn't feel like that. She was not the one who's had this experience of being exposed to other nations and traveling like that. And given the circumstances, I think that we are among friends. And even, well, first of all, we've been really passed from hands of our own friends to others. And even the way that we were lucky to find good accommodation at first, like in a host family, and then we're like the host family are now like extended family now. So this is more than just friends, if you know what I mean. And then the way that we could find accommodation in Cork City, because we first were living in East Cork, in outside the village. So now it was also through friends, like good friends. And when my mother died, like our house was full of friends.
I'm trying to figure out a way of saying this to you. Do we come across to you as a friendly nation?
We do. Why is this thing that...
I guess I'm just curious to know, yeah, because I just think it's funny, there's a lot of stereotypes about Ireland and, this land of a thousand welcomes. And I'm just wondering, have you experienced that in Cork? I mean, is it something that you would probably, I'm trying to put aside the fact that you're here due to the circumstances of the war, but you talked about Belfast, about feeling it's like an uneasy when there, but when now you're in Cork, which is the opposite end of the island, do you feel a much more friendlier atmosphere? Is it a welcoming city?
I probably would say that there are different like dimensions to this, because Belfast in its way, it wasn't unwelcoming. It's just the way that I was really studying the very like painful area. So I was just wearing a banner, oh, I'm a trouble, if you know what I mean, this way. Like, and this is the way that I'm sure that other people are experiencing who are not from, we're not foreigners. I was just trying to follow the footsteps to figure to learn like the contested spheres, let's put it this way, and that it's really, really sad that they are contested in the first place. And I would say that I had this experience that there is this level of friendliness and welcomes, but it was quite hard for me at that time in Belfast to make friends. I didn't eventually make friends. But there was this feeling that as a Ukrainian, we are different. So we are very business as usual on top, but like we are very, well, not all of us, but as a rule of thumb, you probably will have this. Ukrainian, if he likes if he or she likes you, that will be easy to get in to become friends. But in Ireland, there's everybody's friendly, and you're not exactly sure if they actually like you or they're being polite, or there's a moment when you will discover that they are not exactly that friendly. So when we are as refugees in Cork, it's different because it all breaks all the like inner restraints maybe, or this shyness. So we are dealing with lots of friendly people. Like there was a bus, one of the bus drivers in Conna in Fermoy was driving me for free, even though it was 2 euro. I could have afforded it. But said, you're Ukrainian, because I was had small talk with him. It's like, Ukrainian, you're going for free. I was like, what are you doing? But that's what happened, because the grief that the pain that we're enduring now is like overwhelming everyone that I've been dealing with in Ireland. Of course, as a Twitter person, I'm dealing with a lot of abuse too, like
Absolutely,
Irish
yeah.
tankies and racists, and
Yeah.
I get that too. So
Yeah.
I'm not saying that everything's perfect, but as like the majority of people are overwhelmingly supportive wherever you go.
It's funny that you spoke about the bus driver, because I kind of, that's funny. It's in me as well. I kind of, it's kind of over, it's like an overprotection thing, look, we look after you, that kind of thing. And it is very Irish. I'm not surprised, by the way, that you got that experience, even though they tend to, it's like we tend to put aside authority over compassion sometimes. Like in other countries, if it was maybe very strict in terms of their jobs, and so on, they'd say, well, I'd love to be able to do it, but I can't because I'm not allowed by the rules, very Swiss or maybe German or something. It's not being bad, it's just being strict. But in Ireland, we tend to say, ah, sure, look, just go ahead. And we deal with the consequences later. But that's probably going back to what I'm saying to you, is that there's a certain inner experience that we've had. We sympathize with that. We know what it's like to be kind of the immigrant or the refugee abroad, where we've gone to a country which is kind of, wow, God, this is such a big change. Last thing I want to ask you is, I mean, we could spend an hour now, the next hour, talking about what's happening in Ukraine at the moment, but I don't think we need to, because obviously everyone is talking about it. There is one or two questions I do want to ask you, and I want you to put your historian hat on for this one, okay? What possesses people like Putin to do what they do to countries like Ukraine? Because he had it really good for himself. He was on the G6. He was pretty money, whatever money he wanted. He could have anything he wanted. He could have any car, any boat, any book. He could even make movies of himself if he wanted to. He had that situation. He had a situation also to develop. He could have developed into a more humanitarian person and so on. But you know more about this from a historical point of view than I do. And I'm curious to find out, even in 2022, when the world is anyone's oyster, really. It's not like even 100 years ago, where leaders were still very powerful, but still confined to the area that they were in. Nowadays, Putin could have gone anywhere, done anything, could have walked away from it all, had his own social media channel and been loved by everybody. But he chose to invade your country. And now there's no going back for that for him. He's not going to get back on to the pedestal that he was on before. Not only has he ruined the lives of countless millions of people, he's also ruined his own life. So what do you think, as a historian, possesses mainly men to do these things?
My understanding is that Russia is an imperial nation still, and while all the Western nations who used to be empires have been shamed and they've given up their colonies for, well, they lost them in national liberation wars, or they gave up on them because it was too expensive, or it was a combination of both, probably most likely. And there is this worldwide condemnation of imperialism, colonialism. Russia even didn't experience that. Soviet Union was the just a new shape of the Russian Empire, because the Red Army reconquered literally almost every corner of the Russian Empire that used to be there. So Ukrainian National People's Republic fell to the just millions of Red Army soldiers. So for Putin, like he said that himself in one of his speeches, I think it was maybe in the 90s or early 2000s, that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the biggest tragedy to him. And so I think that what drives him is just this urge to restore the empire, the way that, and he sees himself as part of this, as a leader, as a statesman. He wants it back. He wants Russia to feel to be, well, he basically wants to go back, to turn the time back to be this bipolar world when there is Russia. Like the if you remember, like the German Prime Minister Scholz was recently telling him that supposedly he was speaking to Putin. Putin offered him to draw lines on the map and saying, "This is mine. This is yours." It's like, you know, this is like me, Hitler, you know, Hitler Stalin talk, and he lives in that time. And there's this idea that the West has moved on past colonialism, like in the old shape, but it never happened to Russia. So they're basically doing this as normal. Like when Chechnya wanted independence, they wouldn't let them, of course, because this is for them, it's Russia. And so in their thinking, Ukraine is not a real nation, and they want to get it back to the back home with the empire. So that's how I see it. And there is no way of stopping this apart from military defeat.
See, it's for me, I think you kind of hit the nail with the hammer there when you said that it's like a country that hasn't yet got to the stage where power is now different. So like, for example, if you look at, say, somebody like Elon Musk, taking a name of, say, the amount of money that he has to spend, the British Navy spent, I think, $3.8 billion building their latest aircraft carrier. Now, Musk could buy five of those. He could buy a country. He could do all these type of things. He could be that, you know, megalomaniac that we always have in those superhero films. But the thing is, or in the James Bond movies, but the thing is, he doesn't do that because for him, power and wealth and adoration is kind of its now, isn't it? It's kind of a time now where he wants to be loved. He wants to have people going, Musk is brilliant. Musk is amazing. Musk is Tony Stark. You know, all these coming up with these new inventions. But you're saying that Putin is not of this time, in a sense. He's living in this 19th century world where land is power. And land means nothing nowadays, I don't think. You know, I mean, you can have a country like, say, Monaco with all the richest people in the world. It could be the most influential part of the world. And yet, on the map, it's hardly noticeable. But for Putin, is it a case that he just thinks that the bigger the country, the more influence it has?
It's not just the country. Like, wouldn't want to conquer Ireland. I would hope so. But he wants to restore the country that in the way that exists in his mind. That's how I would think. So he sees that the map of USSR was perfect to him, to his idea of statehood, of not what he defines as his nation he belongs to. And so he has to restore that in different ways. Like before even the Russian invasion of Ukraine 2014, there was this talk about building a union state, rebuilding the customs union so that Belarus, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, other states would join in as an alternative to the EU, or basically rebuilding the Soviet Union. And Ukraine is definitely didn't want to go there. That's why it was part of the Euromaidan revolution when Yanukovych didn't sign the EU association agreement, and instead he basically was saying yes to the customs union, and we didn't want to go to another Soviet Union again. But this was the drive that Putin's Russia has been taking. So restoring the might, the power, the greatness.
Yeah, well, he's definitely a doomed man, as I said earlier on. No matter what happens, I mean, his stature in the world is completely destroyed. Now, before I let you go, I want to ask you a question that I ask all of my guests. What are you reading, watching on television, or what are you listening to at the moment?
So it's hard for me to read anything, but I'm trying. So I'm reading slowly Mark Masower's book, "Governing the World: A History of an Idea." It's an academic, it's a popular academic book about history of how we came into the UN and the international law came into being, about what's this, how do we rule the world, govern the world. And ultimately, this is about how do we achieve world peace. And the answer, well, so far, the answer is we don't really. And I'm really satisfying my curiosity because as a Ukrainian, I see that the UN is failing. Our international organizations are useless. The Red Cross is not checking on Ukrainian prisoners of war at all. So what do we do with that? And looking back at how the system came into being is very interesting.
And you don't get to watch TV or anything like that. Nothing bugs you on
I
television.
do. I'm just watching some chewing gums on Netflix just to get distracted. So I was watching the Tinder Swindler or some documentaries about what was that? I'm back on watching Better Call Saul, the season that I was watching right before the invasion. So I'm watching it from, I can't remember what happened, you know, like the early days of the invasion. It's completely wiped out of my mind. So I'm watching season 5 and rediscover that I remember that.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Because like you get just so much TV coming at you now, is that you don't remember as much. You know, like years ago when you'd be watching, say, one or two programs on television, and you'd know exactly what happened at the end of the last season. But I find myself like I'd be watching seasons, and I'd make a break for a few months, and then when I come back and watch that program, I can't remember anything about it. I have to watch some kind of recap that's been done on YouTube and go, oh yeah, okay, now I know where I am. So it's probably because we just have too much TV, regardless of where we are. Nadia, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate that. It's been a great conversation, and I want to say thank you very much to all of you out there for listening to us today. My name is Ken Sweeney, and you've been listening to The Comfortable Spot. So take care, y'all. Bye bye. Thank you.